You're listening to the Judicial Watch Weekly Update with Tom Fitton.
Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here. A lot going on for our weekly update this week on social media. Thank you, as always, for joining us. Supreme Court victory for President Trump and the rule of law. New massive election integrity lawsuit by Judicial Watch. New ethics complaint by Judicial Watch against a compromised senator. It looks like a lot to talk about as our nation continues to be in crisis as a result of the corruption endemic here in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. Now, of course, I'm in an undisclosed location, but things really never stop, even when I leave the office. And along those lines, we had a major Supreme Court ruling this week, 9-0 against the left and Democratic Party's really dishonest attempt to remove President Trump from the ballot. Citing Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which in theory would allow certain officers of the United States to be ruled ineligible to be in office or maybe removed from office if they engaged in some type of insurrection. Of course, that section of the 14th Amendment was passed after the Civil War. And the way the amendment reads, it doesn't apply to Trump. Frankly, it just doesn't apply to Trump. And it certainly doesn't authorize state judges or election bureaucrats or politicians to remove a president from the ballot based on their personal opinion after show trials and you know, fake investigations that he engaged in insurrection. And the goal to remove Trump from the ballot, as I've said before, is an effort to really turn America, it's part of an effort to turn America into a one-party state. If what better way to turn our country into a one-party state than to eliminate from the ballot the number one candidate for the presidency? Now, that's what happens in third world countries. Certainly, as I've discussed before, Putin and the dictator in China, you know, in Cuba and elsewhere, they would recognize what that's all about. And thankfully, the Supreme Court, at least for now, resisted the left's efforts in a unified way to require the president or require the removal of Trump from the ballot in various states. Now, Judicial Watch, along with our friends at the Allied Educational Foundation, we had filed an amicus brief highlighting the chaos that would result in the various states engaging in determinations as to whether or not a candidate was eligible for the presidency under this clause. And as I've highlighted, and I think we highlighted in this case, that if they want to play the insurrection game, there's a lot that can be said about removing Biden from the ballot, certain members of Congress from the ballot for engaging in insurrection, because insurrection, it depends on who's defining it, right? And they've defined it to mean anyone who disputed the 2020 election and tried to pursue that dispute through law under our Constitution, under federal law, and in Congress. Now, others might define insurrection as those blowing up our immigration law and allowing an invasion of the United States. You know, it's in the eye of the beholder, right? And the Supreme Court saw through that and said, no, 9-0. That means every justice, including the extremists who are on the left on the court there, Justice Jackson, Sotomayor, and to a certain extent, Elena Kagan. She's probably not as far to the left as the others, but they're a reliable block. They all agreed that this was inappropriate. So I encourage you to read the decision in its entirety. It's accessible. We'll put a link to it below. But I'm going to read to you a key section of the decision, one which I think that even the liberals didn't disagree with. This is kind of the core holding. Conflicting state outcomes concerning the same candidate could result not just from differing views of the merits, as I highlighted, but from variations in state law governing the proceedings that are necessary to make Section 3 disqualification determinations. Some states might allow a Section 3 challenge to succeed based on a preponderance of the evidence, while others might require a heightened showing. Certain evidence, like the congressional report on which the lower courts relied on here, might be admissible in some states, but inadmissible hearsay in others. Disqualification might be possible only through criminal prosecution, as opposed to expedited civil proceedings in particular states. In some states, unlike Colorado or Maine, where the Secretary of State recently issued an order excluding former President Trump from the primary ballot, procedures for excluding an ineligible candidate from the ballot may not exist at all. The result could well be that a single candidate would be declared ineligible in some states, but not others, based on the same conduct and perhaps even the same factual record. The patchwork would likely result from state enforcement would sever the direct link that the framers found so critical between the national government and the people of the United States as a whole. And they were quoting a prior Supreme Court decision with that language. But in a presidential election, the impact of the votes cast in each state is affected by the votes cast, or in this case, the votes not allowed to be cast for the various candidates in other states. An evolving electoral map could dramatically change the behavior of voters, parties, and states across the country in different ways and at different times. The disruption would all be the more acute and could nullify the votes of millions and change the election result if Section 3 enforcement were attempted after the nation has voted. Nothing in the Constitution requires we endure such chaos, arriving at any time, at different times, up to and perhaps beyond the inauguration. So, that was what the Supreme Court said. And this was my initial reaction to it as it came down. Hey everyone, Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here. Some great news. The Supreme Court ruled 9-0 in favor of President Trump. He will be on the ballot. And the left's efforts to rig the election by removing him from the ballot, frankly, an effort to turn America into a one-party state, has been thwarted by both Republicans and Democrats on the United States Supreme Court. It's a big victory for the Constitution, our constitutional republic, and the rule of law. Now, the left isn't going to stop. They're still trying to jail Trump. But in the meantime, Judicial Watch was proud to participate in this case, and the Supreme Court has more work to do to stop the left's efforts to rig the election. So, of course, the left can't help but try to preserve its ability to disrupt and destroy the republic. And accordingly, the three judges, justices on the Supreme Court on the left, were upset with what turned out to be a majority, it looks like, because Amy Coney Barrett didn't want to go there too, but for different reasons, and didn't want to support the left's crazed attack on the court decision. So the three leftists agreed with the court holding that, you know, states don't have any power to do what they propose to do here, which is to essentially upend our federal presidential election by engaging in a piecemeal analysis of whether the president is eligible or a candidate is eligible under this clause of the 14th Amendment. And the Supreme Court noted that only Congress can enforce it through appropriate legislation. Now, the court, the three justices, they got nervous about that, right? Because they saw through that 5-4 holding, essentially, which is broader than and more specific than the underlying issue that the states can't mess around here, because they want the option, it's clear, for federal judges to come in and throw Trump off. And they're also planning, and this is something that we need more discussion about, because they were also similarly planning in 2020, the left is thinking of ways to upend the election if Trump wins, not because they dispute the outcome of the election in terms of votes cast and the appropriate nature of the election process in terms of, fraud and things like that. They just think that if Trump wins, he should be thrown out and be ruled ineligible from office using this and other reasons, like the 14th Amendment. He was an insurrectionist, so he can't be president, even if Americans select him as president and elect him as president. And it seems to me there are three justices on the Supreme Court who are trying to preserve the ability of the left to upend our republic that way. So in many ways, this case is very satisfactory in the end, because it walled off, for practical purposes, the effort to remove Trump from the ballot. But the reaction to it, and even the three judges on the court, the three justices on the court, their reaction to it suggests the game is not over. They're thinking of other ways to try to remove Trump from office. Some might call that an insurrection, right? Some might call that a coup. Those are the new rules. And that's what the left is planning. They're planning for Congress to overrule the vote of the people. Now, this current Justice Department is prosecuting people who did that, who wanted to challenge the election and use the Electoral College process to challenge the outcome of the election, and from Trump's point of view, vindicate the lawful outcome. Here, they're not even questioning whether the outcome's lawful or not. They just don't think Trump should be president. Now, under the Justice Department's new rules, they should be subject to investigation for conspiracy, right? You don't have to commit the crime. You can conspire to commit the crime of insurrection and to obstruct an election. But of course, you know, the Justice Department isn't going to do that, but just shows you how the Justice Department has been hijacked by the left to promote the destruction of the candidate that is most likely to be Biden. Well, frankly, right now, Trump is going to be the nominee, absent an act of God. He won Super Tuesday. Nikki Haley has removed herself from the race. So he's going to be the nominee. And now the target is, they're going to accelerate, in my view, their operations against Trump, their illicit operations against Trump to try to rig the election. So, you know, as I say here, it was essentially, and I'm giving you all the kind of the warnings about the challenges to Trump and our whole system, our constitutional republic won't stop with this ruling because the court has more to do. But it was a good day. Yes, it was a good day for the rule of law with that Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court made a powerful and unified statement against the brazen, unconstitutional coup by leftists against the constitutional rights of tens of millions of Americans. And thankfully, a Supreme Court majority seems prepared to stop any shady Biden administration and leftist congressional efforts, and I would add judicial efforts, to overturn any Trump victory, again, as I said, based on false allegations of insurrection. So a big victory for the rule of now for the rule of law. But now Trump faces other challenges. They're still pursuing him in federal court with these fake charges related to documents and challenging the election outright. And then, of course, you have the Soros prosecutor up in New York, Alvin Bragg, who is pursuing a prosecution based on a confidentiality agreement, and suggesting that somehow that confidentiality agreement violated federal law. So how you tie federal law to a state prosecution, well, that's an interesting mess he's trying to make up there. But of course, you know, an unprecedented novel application of the law is a key test, in my view, to figure out and to help you figure out whether a prosecution like this is justified. And it's obviously a Democratic Party, because Alvin Bragg is an elected Democrat. He's not an appointed prosecutor. He's an elected prosecutor. It's a conspiracy. Now, you can argue whether it's unlawful or not, but it's a conspiracy to target Trump with this prosecution up in New York. So that's the next case he's facing. And you can bet the left will use that outcome, which before a New York jury is almost preordained, right? New York City jury, given the partisan makeup up there. So we're still in banana republic territory, folks. But Judicial Watch won't back down. We've got our litigation to uncover what the DOJ has been up to uncover what Fannie Willis has been up to. We're monitoring quite closely, and we've litigated over what Alvin Bragg has been up to. You know, we're just not going to stand by and watch the destruction of our republic. We're going to go into court and expose what's going on so you have full access to what your government's up to and the corruption involved in a way, and the corruption that is so destructive to the American way. So with your continued support, you can be sure that we will continue to litigate, investigate, and educate about this dire threat to our Republican form of government through the illicit and illegal targeting of President Trump. And by the way, I want to add something about Trump winning on the election. And don't take this as an endorsement of any candidate, because I'm not allowed to do that, at least through Judicial Watch. I can do it personally. But as president of Judicial Watch, I'm not endorsing or opposing any candidate. But certainly from kind of an objective political analysis view, my view about the president, his remarkable comeback, by any standards, a remarkable comeback of his gaining the nomination again, he's about to gain it officially soon, is a dramatic and historic repudiation of voters of the left's attempts to rig the election, to abuse the rule of law, abuse Trump and other innocents. They're not buying it. And the left has put this narrative out there about January 6th, about the 2020 election, all designed to make it impossible for Trump to come back. And the voters said, no, we're not buying any of it. They rejected their corrupt narratives, their dishonest narratives, narratives designed to destroy your First Amendment rights, help them rig the next election. And voters weren't buying it. And it wasn't just Democrats. You had some Republicans doing this as well, because they just don't like the conservative brand that Trump was selling. So they were willing to let this abuse happen and endorse it. But it didn't work out. And it doesn't mean the threats aren't over from those abuses. But the voters, certainly on the Republican side of the sphere, are saying, we don't buy any of this. Now, you know, if the left media had its way, and I call it the left Borg, and that's a Star Trek reference for those of you who don't know, you can look it up, you'll see what I mean. This group think that tells us we're not allowed to be concerned about election integrity. How dare you demand that there be voter ID? How dare you believe that mass mail-in ballots isn't exactly the best way to ensure that votes are cast accurately and fairly and free of fraud. That ballot harvesting, they say, how dare you try to stop strangers from going around collecting votes from people and showing up with them and dumping them? How dare you object to that? But of course, we're not scared, and we stand strong against this. And one of the ways we stand strong on behalf of free and fair elections is the challenge in federal court. Those states and localities that fail to follow federal law to take reasonable steps to clean up the rolls. And to that end, we just filed another lawsuit against Illinois to require that state to follow the law to clean up the rolls, because the rolls there are a mess. Now, we've done this before. We've done it in California, New York, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Indiana, Ohio. We settled with most of those jurisdictions. Kentucky, I think, was a consent decree. It wasn't a settlement. And all of that has resulted previously in 4 million names being removed from the rolls, 440,000 in New York City. I forget the number in Pennsylvania. 1.2 million was confirmed in LA County alone. So 4 million in the last year or so by Judicial Watch. So we looked at the numbers in Illinois, our election team led by Bob Popper, who's a former Justice Department attorney, civil rights expert, voting law expert, and his voting law colleagues and experts here at Judicial Watch, looked at the available data. And it isn't just, well, Judicial Watch is just making up these numbers. How do we know? We look at the numbers that Illinois' counties present to the federal government, and we see, and then, of course, we ask additional questions as the law allows us to do, and we find out what they're doing, or as importantly, what they're not doing. And according to our lawsuit, they're not doing much of anything in at least 60% of the counties in Illinois to remove the names. And let me give you some of the detail here. 23 Illinois counties with a combined registration list of 980,000 or so voters reported removing a combined total of 100 registrations in the last two-year reporting period under this crucial provision of the federal law that we're trying to enforce here, the National Voter Registration Act. The lawsuit alleges that this is an absurdly small number and contends that there is no possible way these counties can be conducting a general program that makes a reasonable effort to cancel registrations of voters who become ineligible because of a change of residence while removing so few registrations. And generally what the law requires, and we've kind of set the standard as to what the law requires through our previous historic litigation that I talked to you about, is let's say you don't vote in 2022. You didn't vote in the congressional election. Your jurisdiction, either the state or the county, typically your jurisdiction, the responsible jurisdiction, how's that, is supposed to send you a card. I will say it's me. Hey, Tom Fitton, you didn't vote. We don't have a record of you voting. Are you still there? And if you are still there, you know, please let us know. And what happens is, unless the voter responds affirmatively or votes in the two next federal elections, so you don't necessarily have to respond, but if you just show up and vote over the next two federal election cycles, so 2024 and 2026, if you still don't show up and you don't give an answer that you still want to be registered, they're supposed to remove you from the rolls. So what happens is states either don't send the cards out, they don't make any inquiry, and the list just gets dirtier and dirtier, because in America, which is still a free country, people move around a lot, right? And so people move and die. And or if they do send the cards out and they don't follow up, you know, either the person doesn't respond to the card and doesn't vote, and they still don't remove. And so this is like 5 years almost that a voter hasn't been active and they're leaving the names on the rolls. Now, the problem is that dirty names can mean dirty elections. That's why there's this federal requirement that you take reasonable steps to clean up the rolls, because that's a potential pool of dirty voters that can be used to vote illegally, among other reasons, including just the basic reason of Americans don't like it if the rolls have names on there that aren't supposed to be. And it undermines confidence in the elections. Another reason why the feds passed the law. And of course, it was passed in tandem with the Motor Voter Bill. Remember that? So the Motor Voter Bill required states and public agencies to make it easier to register to vote. And the concern was, well, too many people will double register because they'll be asked repeatedly to register to vote, and they won't, you know, the list won't be clean as a result. And the deal was, well, we'll just require the states to take reasonable steps to clean up the rolls. So guess which way the left went? They just enforced the massive registration requirement and ignored the cleanup requirement. So this is a big lawsuit. Illinois is a big state, and there are a lot of major issues. I mean, Cook County, which is where Chicago, you know, is, I don't think they're even reporting that. And, you know, as we lay out, if they're not reporting data, it probably means they don't have good data to report. So they're probably on that list of counties that isn't doing what they're supposed to do in removing the names. And those numbers could be potentially huge. So I'm thinking that there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of extra names on the rolls in Illinois that need to be removed. And I talked about this in announcing the lawsuit, and I made another video on it, which nicely summarizes it for you. And I encourage you to share it as well. So let's run that now. Hey, everyone. Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton here. Election integrity update. Judicial Watch is in federal court
against the state of Illinois because that state and its counties haven't been cleaning up its election rolls. The counties simply haven't been removing names as they're supposed to. That means tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of extra voting names are on the rolls. Dirty election rolls can mean dirty elections. Now, we're not coming to this effort lightly. We've already been in court, and we have results to show for that work. Upwards of 4 million names removed from the rolls in places like New York City, in California, in Pennsylvania. More needs to be done. That's why we're in Illinois now.
So as I note, this isn't our first rodeo, and we've done this type of litigation before. We know what to look for. And it's getting increasingly frustrating, at least to me, as president of Judicial Watch, you know, despite very liberal jurisdictions settling with us when we raise these issues. You know, Los Angeles County in California, they settled with us. Now, did it solve the problem completely in California? I'll talk about that in a minute. New York City settled with us. Pennsylvania settled with us. New York passed, removed 440,000 names, I think, after we blew the whistle as to what they were doing. You know, D.C., we didn't sue, so they didn't settle. They removed 100, they're going to, if they haven't already, remove 138,000 names because of Judicial Watch pressure. And then our lawyers know what they're doing. We're one of some of the top election lawyers in the country. And what they found in Illinois, you know, beyond what I told you earlier, I mean, there's even more. Their own reported data. So this is Illinois material. This is not Judicial Watch's data. This is Illinois' data. Show that more than one-fifth of the counties remove few or no registrations, as I say, under this National Voter Registration Act, this motor voter bill. Illinois informed the Federal Election Assistance Commission that 34 counties simply failed to report any data about removals. Well, you know, no data suggests no removals, in my view, and that's what we alleged. 19 of these counties also failed to report any data regarding registrations removed because of the death of a voter. I mean, that's a really easy, that's what they call, well, I shouldn't say they call, to use the famous phrase or the well-worn phrase, low-hanging fruit. If a county or a state isn't removing dead voters, I mean, what on earth is going on? But that's what's happening in Illinois in too many counties. Dozens of other counties failed to report some other key data to the EAC that provides us reassurance if it was fully reported that the law was being followed. So it's pretty clear the law isn't being followed. And as I say in the release, Illinois voting rolls are a mess. Dirty voting rolls can mean dirty elections. Illinois should take immediate steps to clean its rolls to both prevent fraud and increase voter confidence in the election. So as I said earlier, Judicial Watch is a national leader in the effort to clean up the voting rolls and also to ensure election integrity is upheld in other ways. We filed many, many election law briefs or amicus briefs to preserve and protect voter ID and advocate for that. We've successfully challenged politicized gerrymandering that seek to rig elections by moving voters around, usually based on race or other improper political considerations. And as I said before, we've got this demonstrated record where our heavy lifting has gotten astonishing results to remove upwards of 4 million names from the rolls. And that's just in the last year or two. And we warned Illinois. They didn't take heed of our warning. So we're now in federal court, and it's not just on our behalf, it's on behalf of a voter and two public interest groups in Illinois. One of the great things about working at Judicial Watch is being able to work with great clients, A, who are citizens or whistleblowers, journalists. Yeah, there are good journalists out there. Or activist groups involved in a conservative cause. Sometimes we work with candidates. Not because we're promoting their candidacy, but because they've got claims. And two of the great organizations we're working with in Illinois on this important case are the Illinois Family Action Group which is a nonprofit and tax-exempt legislative action arm of the Illinois Family Institute. It was founded in 2010 to promote the common good and general welfare, primarily by means of education, including direct and grassroots lobbying. It works to advance public policies, to protect the sanctity of human rights, life, Christian marriage, and natural family, and other initiatives which are consistent with principles of good government. So it's a good culturally conservative, Christian-oriented organization that wants to exercise its First Amendment rights and is being harmed by having these dirty voting rolls. It makes it harder for them to do their job. Also, Breakthrough Ideas is a policy advocacy and education network that advances the causes of peace, prosperity, and freedom by highlighting the virtue of taxpayer-centric and liberty-focused policies, and how they benefit all community members. I mean, so a group like that, let's say they want to knock on doors, right? You know, you kind of figure out, well, we want to talk to voters. And if the voter lists are dirty, you're wasting your time and wasting money by knocking on doors of people who are no longer there because they've moved. So this is a great lawsuit against Illinois. California also has a dirty rolls problem, even though LA cleaned up and has got a process in place to clean up. And they've confirmed to us that they've cleaned up 1.6 million names. Other jurisdictions in California aren't doing what they're supposed to do. So litigation there's a significant potential. How's that for a political way of putting it? There's a significant potential for litigation against California over its failure to clean up the rolls. So stay tuned for that. So when it comes to clean elections, Judicial Watch won't ever stop because the battle is ongoing. As I said earlier, the left wants to end elections as we know it by eliminating Trump from the ballot. That's a clean elections issue too, right? And of course, opposing voter ID and any sensible measure to increase voter confidence and ensure your right to vote is secure is something they oppose too. And the conclusion I draw from that is they want either no elections or dirty elections, or they want the ability to steal elections if they don't like the outcome through fraud and other misconduct. And so Judicial Watch will continue to do the heavy lifting for the rule of law on elections. Before I move to the next topic of congressional ethics, in this case, a specific Senate ethics complaint we filed, I want to talk about what the House has done or not done to uphold the rule of law and defund the abuses of power by President Biden. The Republican-controlled House has consistently funded everything they say they hate, practically speaking. Now, I know sometimes there are some things at the margins they're able to get at in these continuing resolutions or their funding fights. But practically speaking, the outrageous, dangerous, destructive effort to jail Trump is fully funded by the Republican-controlled House, repeatedly, time and time again. Does it mean every Republican votes for it? No, but it means about half of them do with every Democrat. Same goes for the Biden border invasion. That's continued to be funded. And every other abuse under the sun that you don't like, including the censorship of Americans and baby killing, abortion, things like that. It's just unbelievable that they haven't curtailed that to any significant extent using the leverage of these continuing resolutions. And a continuing resolution is a process in which the government continues to be funded with congressional authorization, kind of. They just keep on, the money gets that they appropriated just continues to flow from prior years with no checks in place. So that's the continuing resolution until they pass an official appropriation measure for a specific agency. So to that end, there was, they funded five or six agencies through what critics call, and I would call, an omnibus. I don't know why we picked the word omnibus to criticize this, because no normal person knows what an omnibus is. Essentially, it's a gargantuan bill. It was 1,000 pages. It was 1,050 pages. I actually read a good part of it. And on top of that, I think there were, I don't know how many pages of earmarks, but a large number of earmarks. And earmarks are what they call member-directed projects, right? Where a member inserts a specific spending measure to benefit their specific jurisdiction. So a senator, their state, a congressman, usually their own district, congressional district. And that's where a lot of corruption begins and ends in these earmark processes. So that's just another issue that's so outrageous about government or congressional spending. But this bill, the five or six agencies, included the Justice Department. The Justice Department had full funding. They voted with, as I said, that virtually every Democrat and about half of Republicans voted to fully fund the Justice Department's efforts to jail Trump through the end of the year or the end of the fiscal year. So they could have had an amendment, for instance, to say no money for Jack Smith, no money to fund a prosecution of a presidential candidate. They have federal DOJ funds that go to jurisdictions like in New York and New York City and Fulton County, Georgia, and Georgia. No haircuts to them for violating the civil rights of Trump. No effort to ensure federal funding doesn't go to support that abuse of power. So I don't know about you, but I am upset that Republicans in the House and the Republican leadership, Speaker Johnson, who, you know, is generally a pretty conservative guy, but, you know, his analysis and his thinking on this approach to spending, I think, is just wrong. And the idea that they would allow to go through a funding measure that fully funds the Justice Department's jihad against the Republic is just beyond belief to me. Now, there'll be other opportunities to curtail this type of spending because there'll be another giant spending bill that comes up. And so all sorts of opportunities will continue to arise in this regard. And so this is why you have to continue to communicate with your members of Congress. If you think these corruption issues are important, if you think that, for instance, that if Republicans control a House in Congress, maybe they should decline to fund the invasion of the United States that Biden's enabling. Maybe they should decline to fund the Justice Department and other jurisdictions' efforts to rig our election and jail, essentially, and destroy the Republican Party opposition to the Democratic Party that runs the presidency right now and runs the Senate. It's not just here in Washington. It's other states that are doing this. I just read the Arizona, a Democratic Attorney General state. He's thinking of ways to put Republican operatives in jail there for daring to dispute the 2020 election. This is a broad effort to criminalize politics. And I just can't, I you know, I understand there's all sorts of calculations, tactical considerations on these big spending measures, and they don't want to shut the government down. They don't want to shut an agency down. Well, forgive you me. If an agency is trying to destroy the Republic, it should be shut down until those actions that are destroying the Republic are curtailed. Forgive me for thinking that. Now you got me going here. And if you're concerned about these issues and you want to share your views, call your members of Congress, call your senators, because the Senate is now considering what the House just did. So what happens is the House passes it, and then the Senate, they may run amendments. It's unlike they've got, again, the establishment Republican senators will work with the Democrats. I get confused because sometimes Democrats are Republicans and Republicans are Democrats in terms of these policy fights. So there's only about 20 or so Republicans in the Senate that are consistently opposed to this type of spending, these spending monstrosities. And in addition, why on earth would you pass a bill for $460 billion at once? Does that sound like good government to you? So anyway, it's in the Senate, and so they have to pass, and then I guess if there are any changes, it goes to conference or it goes back to the House, and then the president will get to sign it. So the process is still continuing. So it's not too late to call. And as I said, there will be other bills like this for other agencies like DHS, I think, is next. That's where the invasion can be curtailed most directly. Call your members of Congress at 202-225-3121. That's 202-225-3121. So, you know, I talked about earmarks, but there are other ways that Congress can engage in unethical behavior or individual members can. And I guess one of the tried and true ways is to have your spouses or members of your family get involved in politics in a way that trades on your name. And Joe Biden, obviously, being the epitome of this. We all think, we're all led to believe that this corruption began only when he was vice president. Well, someone like Biden, he's been doing that for years, even when he was Senate, you can be sure of that. So, you know, the way it works is that you have members of your family that engage in lobbying or consulting on areas of public policy. And the concern is, and what ethics rules require you to do, is to avoid the appearance or actually doing any favors to benefit your spouse. Now, it's one thing to support, let's say your spouse is in the Senate, is, you know, just involved in a particular cause, and you kind of share the same outlook, you end up voting in ways that advance that cause. That's not the issue here. The issue is the level of specific work that you do to advance the organizations which your wife is affiliated. And that's what seemed to be happening with a notorious left-wing senator, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, who has been obsessed with alleging, quite often falsely and without foundation or using dubious analysis, supposed conflicts of interest of Supreme Court justices he doesn't like. He doesn't like the idea, for instance, of amicus briefs filed by corporations. He wants all of that fully disclosed, undermining the First Amendment rights of everyone trying to litigate in the courts. And it turns out he has significant ethics issues that Judicial Watch, he's a powerful senator, took on. And we filed an official ethics complaint with the Senate Select Committee on Ethics to investigate the relationship between Sheldon Whitehouse's activities as a senator and his wife's concerns as a consultant. So this is what our complaint points out. The publicly available facts suggest that Senator Whitehouse's legislative activity, particularly his sponsorship of environmental legislation funding his wife's clients and her specific area of expertise, marine spatial planning. I didn't know there was such an expertise, but I guess there is. Creates a reasonable appearance of a conflict of interest. Given this, further investigation regarding Mrs. Whitehouse's consulting activities, aided by the committee subpoena power, is warranted. And this is what's going on. His wife, Sandra Thornton Whitehouse, is the president of Ocean Wonks, W-O-N-K-S, LLC, a for-profit, limited liability environmental consulting company that was chartered in 2017 and has its principal place of business in Rhode Island. Senator Whitehouse, as I said, is a senator from Rhode Island. Shortly after her husband's election to the Senate in 2009, Mrs. Whitehouse and later her company Ocean Wonks became a consultant to at least two known nonprofit corporations focused on environmental issues, the Ocean Conservancy and Alta Sea. Influence Watch, an entity that investigates these types of connections, found that Senator Whitehouse's spouse made over $2.6 million in total compensation from the Ocean Conservancy since 2009, when Whitehouse came into office. Her present level of compensation would make her the eighth highest earner among the employees there, higher than several vice presidents of the Ocean Conservancy. According to a May 2023 report by our friends over at the Daily Caller, since his election to the Senate, Whitehouse has introduced at least 24 ocean-related bills and co-founded the Senate Oceans Caucus in 2011. Now, we provide in the complaint, and I encourage you to read the entire complaint. It's very interesting. You know, these ethics issues can sometimes run. Sometimes these members of Congress have plausible deniability, right? They're kind of separate enough, but his work here crossed the line. And we make a compelling case in the complaint. So in our complaint, we list 24 pieces of legislation that, when you look at it or look at them, strongly indicate that they were passed in a way that would directly benefit and arguably did benefit the senator's wife's consultancy, the companies that she helps. And so when you look at the list of, I call it litigation, legislation, it's legislation, you'll see, and some of them have been, a lot of it's been passed into law, but you got money flowing in a way that would benefit her clients, and if not her directly. So we make a strong case because it's based on publicly available information about what the legislation does. So it's not like we have to dive into the secret finances of the White House family to find this information. And when you look at the ties between the legislation and Mrs. Whitehouse, it's pretty devastating. So we cite the ethics rule at issue here. It's the conflict of interest rule, and it's pretty straightforward. Paragraph 1 of the Senate Ethics Rule 37 states, a member shall not receive any compensation, nor shall he permit any compensation to accrue to his beneficial interest from any source, the receipt or accrual of which would occur by virtue of influence improperly exerted from his position as a member, officer, or employee. Paragraph of 4 of 37, this Rule 37, further declares that a senator shall not, quote, knowingly use his official position to introduce or aid the progress of passage or passage of legislation, a principal purpose of which is to further only his pecuniary interest, only the pecuniary interest of his immediate family, or only the pecuniary interest of a limited class of persons or enterprises when he or his immediate family or enterprises controlled by them are members of the affected class. The rule's prohibition of conflicts of interest are designed to be broad and robust. There's a report that accompanies the rule that describes its prior application. It states that the prohibitions on conflicts of interest are specifically designed to prevent conflict of interest or the appearance of such conflict of interest, which is equally damaging to public confidence. So it's not only the actual conflict of interest, but the appearance of the conflict of interest. That's the standard. This rule prohibits a member from working for legislation, a principal purpose of which is to enhance his financial interest or the interests of his family. Now, of course, being married to Mrs. Whitehouse, it advances not only his financial interest, because presumably, you know, her money is there, his money, but obviously she gets a cut too. Paragraph 1 was intended as a broad prohibition against members deriving financial benefit directly or indirectly from the use of the official position. It's broader than quid pro quo bribery. So we're not just looking for bribery here. For example, if a senator intervened with an executive agency for the purpose of influencing a decision which would result in measurable personal financial gain for him, the provisions of this paragraph would be violated. Thus, if a senator uses his official position in a manner that benefits him indirectly through the spouse, such spousal compensation would accrue to his beneficial interest and violate paragraph 1. So this is a serious issue, in my view, for Senator Whitehouse. And the question is the Ethics Committee, which is comprised, unlike usual committees, of Republicans and Democrats in equal number, I forget the actual number of Senate Ethics Committee members, whether they're going to do something about this. Given Senator Whitehouse's longstanding practice of sponsoring or co-sponsoring legislation that indirectly benefits his wife and or her clients, we urge the Senate Ethics Committee to conduct a preliminary investigation to disinter the full extent of Mrs. Whitehouse's consulting agreements with both for-profit and nonprofit entities that may create a reasonable appearance of conflict of interest with her duties. So we'll put up a screenshot of the New York Post here. You can see the New York Post covered this story, and other media are covering this story as well. And it's up to you, dear listener, dear viewer, to call your senator and ask them what they are going to do about this ethics issue concerning Senator Whitehouse. Now, some of them may be uncomfortable because they've got spouses who are doing the same thing, and but for the grace of God, go them when they look at what Senator Whitehouse is up to. But nevertheless, this is a pretty readily apparent issue of a conflict of interest that deserves full investigation by the Senate Ethics Committee, not the cursory, we got your letter, we don't like it, and therefore we're not going to pursue it. And this is what I said about it in our release on the topic. There's strong evidence that Senator Whitehouse may have violated Senate ethics conflicts of interest rules. The Ethics Committee should immediately investigate this serious issue. Senator Whitehouse seems to have stepped over the line of standard environmental legislative advocacy and used his Senate office to advance his and his wife's personal and financial interests. So, Senator Whitehouse is a powerful, influential senator. You may not know him, but he's one of the top senators on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And, you know, senators just even individually are kind of uniquely powerful in our constitutional republic. And so the idea that they be held accountable to the really rarely enforced ethics rules in the Senate, I think should go without saying. So as I said, call your senators, ask them what they think, and to review Judicial Watch's Senate ethics complaint, which we'll put a link to below, put a link to our release. You can see the complaint there. And, you know, this is, Judicial Watch is effective, obviously, because of the work we do, the litigation, this complaint that we filed. You know, we are direct in sense we just don't complain about something, we do something. We either file lawsuits or demand action through an ethics complaint, pursue FOIA investigations. But because we have such a strong following, millions of Americans support our work, that's where the power comes from to affect change and protect the rule of law. So if you follow up on this through phone calls to your senators, it's going to get attention, believe you me. And I know my voice reaches millions through the internet, through Judicial Watch's other communication streams. But I can tell you, if just even a fraction communicate with their senators, we will get some significant action, I would think, from the Senate. So I encourage you to call your senators at 202-225-3121, 202-225-3121. So a lot going on, rule of law vindicated, Judicial Watch in federal court to uphold fair and clean elections by requiring a key state to clean up its rolls, major ethics complaint against one of the most powerful senators in the United States Senate. So much going on, and I tell you, much more is coming. So you're going to want to come back for our next weekly update next week, God willing. I'll see you. God bless you, and God bless America.
Thanks for listening to the Judicial Watch Weekly Update with Tom Fitton. For more information, visit www.judicialwatch.org, because no one is above the law.